Time now on Radio 3 to join Lucy Skeeping for the Early Music Show. And as part of the BBC's special season on aspects of dance today, she's got her dancing shoes on.
So often in these programmes, I find myself introducing things like galliards, pavans and minuets, dances that were as popular in their time as, say, the waltz is today, or at least was until general all-purpose bopping around took over sometime in the 1960s. I don't know about you, but one of the things that really helps me appreciate early music is to picture it in context. You know, places like the great music room of some Gonzaga palace or the banqueting house at Whitehall, places where parties, feasting and of course dancing happened on a regular basis. We can look at a painting to get an idea of the clothes or the frescoes, the table decorations and so on. But what actually did those dances look like? I mean, did everyone line up with their partners like square dance, or did they stand and watch as perhaps just one or two couples went through their paces? Perhaps they galloped about in those heavy, sweaty costumes. Was there any smooching during the slow dances? After all, candlelight does have a magic of its own. Well, I've come to a little dance studio in Islington today, and it's the home of one of our leading experts in historic dance, Barbara Siegel, and she's promised to take me and my producer Les through our paces. I've also persuaded some of my colleagues from the City Waits to join us, the lutenist Robin Jeffrey, Richard Boothby on bass viol, and my husband Roddy Skeeping on the violin. Barbara, the music we've just heard came from a Renaissance extravaganza, didn't it? A sort of musical entertainment, I think, for a wedding.
Yes, it was the sixth intermedio from La Pellegrina, one of the Medici extravaganzas. Whenever there was a very important marriage or a celebration, a very important person came to town, they would have a big extravaganza. All the stops were pulled out for these performances. And they wouldn't last just a few hours. They'd probably go on for days.
But of course, the participants were the nobles themselves, in a sense, weren't they? Or did they get professionals in to do these things?
The nobles, who were the high-status courtiers, did all the what was called noble dances, and professionals came in to do what we would think of as virtuoso dancing now. Whenever you did multiple turns or put your legs up very high or did very high jumps, it was considered somewhat grotesque, and the professional dancers did these.
What do we know about the actual steps? How do we know what the dances looked like?
Very little survives from the extravaganzas. We do have a few accounts in Italy written down of performances from theatrical productions at court. In this particular one, Cavalieri composed the music and the dancing. And we know, for instance, that in the grand finale that we've just heard, there were 27 dancers on stage. Many of them would have done just dancing, but most of them would have played music, sung, and danced at the same time.
I mean, the intermedia itself is quite an interesting thing, isn't it? Because, as the name suggests, they were literally interludes, these musical interludes, which did they not take place in between the acts of a play?
Yes, they started off as interludes between the acts of a play, but then they got so extravagant that it was these that the people wanted to see. They had magnificent costumes, they had fabulous scenic effects, so the whole thing would have looked really impressive.
It's hard for us to imagine now how they would have done some of these amazing effects, because of course there must have been various people pulling on heavy ropes to make sure people got off the ground. I mean, it must have been quite a sweat, actually.
Yes, I know in England, in the theatres, there used to be more people doing the stage effects than actors or singers on the stage.
Did styles of dance travel around Europe? Would you have found, say, the same dances in Italy as you would, say, in France?
Yes, all through the Renaissance period, the dance style in the European courts was very much dominated by Italian dancing. Italian dance masters went everywhere, all over Europe. And Catherine de' Medici was the Queen of France at this time, and she would have brought her a huge retinue of Italians and a very strong Italian influence. And she herself had a very significant role in producing these ballets. And she was a very good dancer herself.
Of course, the word ballet, as far as I'm concerned, is French, isn't it?
Yes, and this one, Le Ballet Comique, is very important to us because in this work, all the elements of the entertainment, the dance, the music, the words, were drawn together to tell a complete story. So people very frequently refer to this as the first ever ballet in its modern sense.
Let's hear some of that now then. This is Le Ballet Comique de la Reine of 1581. Music from Le Ballet Comique de la Reine. Barbara, many of these great sort of entertainments were not just for the great pleasure of watching, were they? Because they did have, there was a certain PR exercise involved.
In these extravaganzas, the forces of evil, here the enchantress Circe, would be pitted against the forces that represent the power and goodness of the monarch. And the dancing itself was important for expressing the virtues of the monarch, because the dancing expressed good proportions, both the line of the dancers themselves and also the harmoniousness of the dance figures that represent harmony and goodness. And these, of course, represent the harmony and goodness and power of the monarch.
Well, what we've just heard was from the late 16th century. Do we know anything about the earlier period, some of these entertainments and dances?
Yes, before this, there were much smaller scale entertainments, but fairly similar. For instance, in the late 14th century, there was a wedding at court, and there was an entertainment by five wild men of the woods. They had costumes made of flax and feathers, and they looked very wild and hairy. And they were soaked in a resinous wax. The whole thing must have been highly inflammable. Wouldn't be allowed by health and safety rules today. But even then, they thought it was very dangerous, and the usual burning of torches was forbidden just during this entertainment. However, The king's brother came up very close with a candle, probably to see who the dancers were, and he caught one of them alight. Then all of them caught on fire, because they're all chained together. But fortunately, the king's aunt knew that one of the wild men was her nephew, King Charles II of France, so she quickly threw her robe over him, saving his life. The others weren't so lucky.
It's incredible to think that so the king would have been one of these costumed dancers. I mean, would he normally have been incognito like that?
Usually, noble people were not allowed to do what was called grotesque dancing. This was very definitely grotesque dancing. But because he was masked, he was allowed to do things that he couldn't do if acting in his own role as king.
The spectators, I suppose, at the end of these wonderful occasions would themselves join in with the dancers. They'd kind of get up from their seats, I suppose, and join in with them, would they?
The
participation was a big thing even then.
Yes, the performers would come down off their stage and invite the members of the audience to dance, the social dancers of the day, with them.
Well, in the interest of historical research, I feel I need to empathise with these dancers, which probably means I'm going to ask you to teach me a little bit of dance, and I think Les, our producer, is... You're up for it, aren't you, Les?
Are you asking?
Yeah, definitely. Come take my hand.
Let's start with a nice, easy dance. The pavan, a slow and stately dance. It was often danced by a couple, but also very frequently by a column of people in a procession. It's rather like a ceremonial dance. You parade around slowly at the beginning of a ball, displaying your rich clothes and good deportment. Then you can carry on with the rest of the dancing. So you hold hands.
Oh dear, this is a first.
You must have your lady on your right-hand side. Your right hand is your honoured hand, and it would be a great insult if you put your lady on your left-hand side.
Well, which side has he got his sword, though? That's what I want to know.
He'd had his sword on his left side, and his left hand would be controlling it to see that it didn't swing around too much. And then, if the need arises, he can quickly take it out with his right hand. So it's left, touch, right, touch, left, right, left, touch. So one step and touch and three steps and touch.
Left, together, right, together, left, right, left, together. This way, Les. Whoops, left. No, right first, the second time. We've gone wrong already.
Shall we do it to some music?
I think that would help. Strike up the band. Right, this is us, I think. Here we go. Step together. Step together. Step. Step together. It's going very well so far. And let the musicians finish. French pavan, and very well known, I think, to many people as the piece that Peter Warlock used for the Capriol suite as well. How did we do, Barbara?
Very good for a first class. After a while, you have to start putting a sort of swaying movement into it.
I noticed you were ahead of us, and there was all sorts of little...
It was called a sort of pavanajasi, which is a peacocking or a sort of swaggering music. And then, when you've mastered the simple processional pavan, there are pavan-like dances where you put more complicated figures in. You go to the side and change places, etc. You might even be asked to embrace your partner. And an embrace did mean kissing your partner. And it did mean kissing them on the lips.
Should we pass on that one?
I can't do that yet. husband's on the violin.
So let's talk a little bit about what was going on in England now, Barbara. Were Italian or French dancers popular in the English court?
Yes, they were very popular. And just like the Intermedi in Italy and the Ballet du Cour in France, you had the English masks in England. And you had people like Ben Jonson on the words and Inigo Jones on stage design. And there were spectacular effects and dazzling costumes. In fact, in one of the masks, and I think we're going to hear the music for that, Prince Henry, who was the older brother of Charles I, who died quite young, he was the hero of the piece, and he entered on a chariot that was pulled by two white bears. So it would have been pretty impressive. But more important than Inigo Jones and Ben Jonson were the choreographers of the day, because, as in Italy and France, it was the dancing that was the most important element of these extravaganzas. And we know how important they are, because if you look at the fees paid to the choreographers, they were higher than those paid to Jonson and Jones.
Mask of Oberon, first performed at the Banqueting House in London's Whitehall in 1611. This is the Early Music Show. I'm Lucy Skeeping, and today we're talking about Renaissance dance. Barbara, as we've heard, the dancers themselves tended to be the partygoers, the courtiers, the nobles. But it was very, very important they didn't lose their dignity, wasn't it?
Yes, so they would represent harmony with their wonderful lines, the wonderful lines of their body and the beautiful patterns that they formed with their steps. But there was another group of people who took part in what was called the anti-mask section. And this served as a foil to the noble maskers. They did what was called grotesque dancing. And these people would be professional dancers. They'd do virtuoso dancing, very athletic, big leaps and turns, and also grotesque gestures and grotesque mime. And these anti-maskers portrayed the forces of evil that need to be subdued by the harmony represented by the dancing of the noble maskers. And of course, this in turn represented the harmonious, good, just, and all-powerful monarch.
I think we should get on with another dance. The galliard, I think, is the next one we're going to learn.
Well, first of all, Les, you're allowed to take your sword off for this dance.
It was weighing you down, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
Although this was often danced for a couple, it was really a show-off dance for men. It was very frequently done as a solo. And the man for the galliard could make large athletic jumps, multiple turns and capers, and display virtuoso technique. And it wasn't just the lady that you might want to impress either. Queen Elizabeth was very susceptible to taking a liking for people who cut a mean caper on the dance floor. It was rumoured that Sir Christopher Hatton got his job at court because he danced very well in the galliard. But you mustn't be too energetic, because the sweat would offend polite society. And above all, you have to look nonchalant. So you might practice your galliards at home for 10 hours a day, but when you came to the dance floor, you must look as if you've just thrown it off without any practice at all. So let's see what stuff you're made of, Les.
So what's the basic?
So it's
one, two. We're kicking our legs out to the front at the moment.
Jump.
And then jump.
One,
and then the same the other
three,
way around.
Four.
And then jump together.
One, two.
Sorry, I've got my feet back to front.
One, two, kicking three, forward, four, jump six. Together. It's six beats, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll try and count them. Two, three, four, five, six. One, two, three, four, five, six.
So you can have your cadenza, you usually have your cadenza after, or on five and six, but you can make your variation longer and longer and have it on 11, 12.
What do you mean by cadenza? You mean there's going to be some flourish somewhere?
Yes, so the cadenza is the pause and jump. And the cadenza, yes, it should be a flourish. For instance, no self-respecting man would even think that a single turn in the air was good enough for a flourish. You really have to have a double turn at the end. So you might go one, two, three, four, pause, and then a triple turn or a double turn in the air.
Sounds like ice skating.
I was just about to say, yes. Okay, so one, two, three, four, five, six. Okay, so for the benefit of those who can't see, we're kicking our legs forward, but with pointy feet, so it's quite graceful.
It doesn't have to be forward. It could be one, two, three, four, five, six.
Oh, right. So the legs can be kicking
easy.
Back as well, yes.
Yes.
One, two, three, four, five, six. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Yes, anything you like.
Right.
In fact, the dancing masters at the time produced books with hundreds and hundreds of variations that you could learn, but really, it was up to you to improvise your own variations.
Let's go.
Elizabeth would do five or six galliards of a morning to warm herself up before breakfast.
It's quite aerobic, actually.
No, I'm not sure she'd be very impressed with mine.
Now, the next dance, has got a good name because it's called a brawl, isn't it? Which it would always have that bar and brawl feel about it, and people punching each other. Is it that wild and energetic, a brawl?
Yeah, so in England they were called brawls, and they used to make puns on this word.
But they were full of fantasy, weren't they? It was almost a mime thing.
Yes, a lot of them had mime in. For instance, there'd be people pretending to be peas popping out of shells and making little jumps along the line, or scraping the floor and pretending to be horses, or slapping their hands and pretending to do the washing.
All doing the same act in a slightly Busby Berkeley-esque.
Indeed, yes.
And was this the light relief after the graceful galliards and things, or is this just another dance for everyone?
They usually did the brawls at the beginning of the evening.
Thank you. those were three brawls, which sound like quite fun dances to me. The other one, which is a bit more famous than the rest, is the Volta, which I think is rather energetic, because there's a lot of throwing people around, isn't there?
Yes, it's very nice for the lady. I mean, basically, in the Volta, the man throws the lady into the air, and he boots her around in the air by putting his knee under her bottom. He's got one hand under her busk, and that's the long wooden piece inserted in the front of her dress. And the bottom of this is around about her crotch area. It was considered very scandalous at the time. People attributed murders and certainly miscarriages to it, and it was also thought to bring about uncleanly gropings.
Mm.
But when the lady was thrown into the air, she'd have one hand on the man's shoulder and one hand modestly holding her petticoats down.
And this was very popular in the Elizabethan court particularly?
Yes. I mean, a lot of people disapproved of it. But since Queen Elizabeth loved it, people were allowed to do it at court. It had the Queen's blessing.
Let's do it. Where do you want us?
So it starts off with you doing just a few travelling steps, which is just hop, step and jump, hop, step and jump,
hop, step and jump. I see, so we're
hop, step,
really walking forward, jump, just hopping together.
Hop, step and jump. The man will turn to you, be by your side. You'll put your hand on his shoulder. He'll have that in his back. He'll have this one under your busk. He'll make a little movement and then one, two, you bend on two, thump, bump, back.
And then he throws me up in the air.
One, two, three, four, five, six. So on four, you have to go up.
It's far too complicated.
And this leg goes under her bottom and helps her go up, preferably a whole turn.
Right.
I'm sure we've got enough space for whole turns,
haven't you? Excuses. Come on.
Yeah. Yes. So it's easy to do with the music, so
that you can
time. So you can time the bend.
One, two, three.
Step and jump, hop, step and jump. Is this the lift now? Here we go.
When the ladies flew around, the petticoats did go up a bit, and they used to have embroidered socks, and these could be seen. And so the sock makers did more and more elaborately embroidered socks, and then the ladies would want to be thrown higher and higher, so their socks could be seen.
So it really was quite a sexy, daring dance,
yes,
wasn't it?
It was considered very scandalous. Religious writers used to damn it.
Well, although Les and I have been making a terrible fuss about all this, those are not really complicated dances, are they? There were much more complicated ones in Italy particularly, I think.
A lot of the Italian ones had different changes of rhythm, and you do a bit of Galliard and a bit of Canary and a bit of Saltarello, etc., etc. And they were much harder to learn. This is really just one basic movement.
About songs, we've got our three instrumentalists here. Do you think people might have danced to the sound of a voice as well, to a singer? Oh. I suppose in a little theatrical piece, a mask or something, that must have happened.
Yes, certainly. In fact, people sung and danced at the same time. And there are quite a lot of dancers that were either set to songs or songs were set to the dancers.
OK, well, let's hear one now. This is an Italian balletto.
Thank you.
Celeste Giglio. That was a balletto, a dance, which really incorporated four different rhythms, didn't it? Because we had the slow bit, then we had the galliard, and then the last two dances, Saltarello and a canary. Is that anything to do with the Canary Islands or the bird?
Well, the dance itself was a very wild, exotic dance, and people said at the time that it came from the Canary Islands, and the movements were very like what the natives, inhabitants...
Not what they do in Lanzarote nowadays, I don't think.
The man and the woman stand side by side, and it's rather like the galliard. They turn around for a bit, and then they go to each side of the room. And then each in turn advances on the other one, doing stamping movements, then retreats. And just as with the galliard, there were lots and lots of canary variations published, but a good dancer would always improvise his own steps. The steps are not unlike tap dancing today. It starts with a travelling step, and Arbeau, who wrote a dance text at the end of the 16th century, he said that this travelling step was meant to be done as if one were treading down spittle or killing a spider.
You're sliding along the floor, rather.
Well, you have to behave as if you're treading down spittle.
Or a spittle, yes.
Killing a spider.
Remember the spittle. Slide,
one,
yes, and stamp.
And two. And one, and two, and one, and two. And then, so you come in, and then you wander around for a bit, and then you separate to either side of the room. First of all, the man, then the lady advances and retreats, doing steps like dum, da dum, dum, ba dum.
Certainly got a very Spanish, what we might call flamenco,
yes,
thing,
yes,
today. Do they look,
yes,
at each other in a threatening manner, the man and woman?
Possibly.
Well, we'll do it, shall we, anyway?
Depends on their relationship.
Step shuffle. You have to have your head up in a very proud way, don't you? Slide, stamp, stamp, slide.
So if you go to the side.
Oh, I'm going to retreat now, am I?
Solo.
Now the man is coming towards me.
Then retreat a bit.
And just little steps backwards.
So. Then you both go around in a circle.
Both round in the
circle. On a spot. On a spot.
And now it's your turn to attack. Well, that was the canaria, or the grand canaria, as I like to call it. We talked about dancing in theatrical productions at court and so on, but what about the more rough stuff, the dancing in public places, perhaps theatres? What sort of thing would we expect to see, say, in England?
Well, there was a lot of dancing in the theatre. If you read Shakespeare, his texts are full of references to dancing. And there was a lot of dancing in the performances. We think that the performances were probably about 50% longer than they are today because of all the physical action that took place. And there'd be Morris dancing, jigs, all sorts of dancing within the plays. And then at the beginning of the play, at the intervals, and at the end, there'd be even more dancing. At the end, there was often what they called a jig, which was not just a dance, it was a story, and it was usually told through a song, and the dancer would mime the actions. And these could be quite bawdy.
One of the most famous the jig writers was this chap, Will Kemp. I think he was a dancer as well, wasn't he?
Yes, well, he was a comic actor. They were often called clowns. in Shakespeare's time. In fact, he was a member of Shakespeare's company, and he was very famous for his stage jigs. But at the height of his fame, Kemp decided to leave Shakespeare's company and to dance all the way from London to Norwich in 9 days. Well, actually, it took him about 27 days, but he said he only danced on 9 of these.
Was it like some kind of sponsored walk or dance?
Yes, yes. Nobody knows quite why he decided to leave, but it was a sponsored dance, and he did raise quite a bit of, well, he raised some money for himself, but it certainly did give him fame, and it was partly because he wrote down his account, and this was published as the 9 Days Wonder. Kemp described his dance as a Morris dance.
It's quite an interesting word, Morris, because most of us will be familiar with the guys that turn up on a Sunday on a warm Sunday afternoon in white trousers with little hankies and bells, which I know some people think is quite amusing, but I really like them. And we call those Morris dancers now. But
originally, there would have been professional dancers who were highly paid, and they went round the courts doing very athletic dancing. But some time in the sort of 14th, 15th, 16th century, this was taken over by, or particularly by guild people who performed in processions and did things that were called Morris dancing, which were probably influenced by local dancers that they did, by the old Morisco dancers that would have been seen. But in Shakespeare's time, it wouldn't have taken on the form of the sort of six dancers, three dancers facing each other that we see now. This was probably very much influenced by English country dancing, which started in the late 16th century.
Well, we know that Kemp had his pipe and tabor with him on this long 9 days wonder, this dance up to Norwich. In fact, there's a very nice woodcut showing him at it. Let's hear, to finish then, Barbara, a piece of music that perhaps is related to that event.
Yes, I think we have no idea, of course, what music would have been played, but I think this is a good example of the kind of music that might have been used to accompany a dance like Kemp's. And if you listen to the recording, there's a solo section played on the pipe and tabor. So you can imagine Tom Sly, who was Will Kemp's taborer, who played all the way from London to Norwich, probably more onerous job than dancing all the way. You can imagine that that's him, and you'll also hear bells. So you can imagine that these are the bells on Will Kemp's legs as he danced, as he jigged all the way from London to Norwich.
a Morisque, possibly having been danced by Will Kemp, Shakespeare's clown, we never know. Well, thanks very, very much, Barbara, for inviting us into your studio and putting Les and me through our paces, because do you think we were good students?
Very good indeed. Very promising. I think you should go to a dancing school and learn how to do it properly.
I'm going to get in a hot bath. I don't know about you. Anyway, I think we ought to have the City Waits to play us out, so thank you.
City Waits played that final Galliard on today's Early Music Show. Lucy Skeeping was in conversation with and under tuition from Barbara Siegel, and the programme was produced by Les Pratt. On next week's Early Music Show, continuing the special dance season on the BBC, Baroque dance specialist Philippa Waite looks at the different styles of various dances. That's here on BBC Radio 3 next Sunday afternoon at the usual time, 2 o'clock.
This week, live in concert on BBC Radio 3 is all over the place. Live in Concert presents a week of diverse music from across the UK. That includes Mozart and Stravinsky from Birmingham Town Hall, Verdi's Requiem live from the Lighthouse in Poole, BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra are live in Glasgow, and the BBC National Orchestra and Chorus of Wales perform Haydn's Creation live from St David's Hall, Cardiff. Live on air and via the Radio 3 website, Live in Concert, throughout the week at 7:30. The best seat in the house, here on BBC Radio 3.
Back to this Sunday afternoon. It's just gone 3 o'clock and time now for Choral Evensong, which was first broadcast on Wednesday from Exeter Cathedral. The canticles were composed by Herbert Howells in 1945 for the choir of King's College, Cambridge, Collegium Regale. And the anthem, Hear My Words, Ye People, by Sir Hubert Parry, was first heard at the Salisbury Diocesan Choral Association Festival in 1894. It follows the format of a 16th or 17th century verse anthem, but on a grander scale, concluding with the celebrated setting of Henry Baker's hymn, a paraphrase of Psalm 150, O Praise Ye the Lord. The service begins now with a setting by Patrick Hadley, first published in 1938, of verses from Chapter 2 of the Song of Solomon. My beloved spake and said unto me, Rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away.
Good afternoon and a warm welcome to Exeter Cathedral for this service of choral evensong. Choir now sings Psalms 142 and 143.